welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In his book, The Greatest Generation, Tom Brokaw wrote that those who lived through the Great Depression and fought in World War II were the greatest generation any society has ever produced. This week, in the third show in our four-part series on The Greatest Generation, we take a closer look at that segment of America's past with historian David Kennedy. We'll also hear from Robert Stinnett on whether Admiral Husband Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short were guilty, as charged, of failing to anticipate the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and Dr. America will be with us once again, this time sharing his thoughts on Christmas, which is just around the corner. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On December 4, 1918, President Woodrow Wilson set sail for France to attend the Versailles Peace Conference with the intention of making the world, shaken by the First World War, safe for democracy. Wilson embarked on a transatlantic journey that began with high hopes and ended in disappointment. He fought for his pet project for world peace, the 14 points, but other Allied leaders were determined to reap the spoils of war at Germany's expense, thus compromising Wilson's proposals. Wilson did manage to prevent the dismemberment of Germany and to gain acceptance for his League of Nations. The U.S. Senate, however, resisted that part of the Treaty of Versailles, forcing Wilson to take it to the people. He embarked on a whirlwind cross-country tour, giving 39 speeches in 3 weeks, which led to a massive stroke that left him partially paralyzed. Broken physically and emotionally, Wilson watched as the U.S. Senate failed to ratify the Treaty of Versailles and joined the League, the world's first significant attempt at creating an international body to work for world peace. This is Talking History. We may see them today as the greatest generation, those young men and women who lived through the Great Depression and fought in World War II, but older adults in the 1930s and early 1940s did not think so highly of them. Some of the leading spokesmen of the day described them as having so little education they could hardly participate in a democracy, and as exhibiting such moral relativism they could never muster the idealism to fight Adolf Hitler. That is the generation Fred Nielsen looks at this week in his conversation with historian David Kennedy.
My guest, David Kennedy of Stanford University, is one of the leading historians of the United States in the first half of the 20th century. Among his books are Over Here, The First World War in American Society, and more recently, Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War, which received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Kennedy, welcome.
Well, thanks, Brent. It's nice to be here with you.
Perhaps we could begin by describing the American people on the eve of World War II. How many were there? Where did they live? How were they divided by race and ethnic background?
Well, there were about 130 million of us, a little less than half the number there are today, in the United States in census 1940, the eve of the war. The African American population, interestingly, was still in that era very heavily concentrated in the 11 states of the former Confederacy. About 80% of all African-Americans still lived in the Old South. The great migration out of the South was triggered by World War II, but hadn't happened yet. And we were also then, as we've been at many moments in our history, quite an ethnically various people. The great waves of immigration that had arrived around the turn of the century, mostly from Europe, a little bit from Asia, and then it ended in the 1920s, of course, but those great immigrant communities had matured to a certain degree. They were second-generation communities, even third-generation in some cases. But roughly 10% of the American people in 1940 were still foreign-born, which is roughly the same percentage as today, as a matter of fact.
This is a time of considerable crisis in America, both economic and political. We have in the 1930s the Great Depression, and in the 40s World War II. How did those experiences shape the Americans who lived through them? Or I wonder actually if it's possible to speak in the singular here, given the diversity of the American people.
Well, you're absolutely right that we were then, as we've often been, a very diverse people, and it's dangerous to speak in generalizations. But the Depression, mind you, was an 11-year-long experience. It commenced in 1929. Lasted until 1940, even 1941, so it's better than a decade. And that experience put a deep stamp, I think, on everybody who lived through it. There are people still alive today, obviously, who still bear the scars of that that great moment. In some ways, I would say, and I've noticed this actually when I've gone around the country talking about my book or whatever, that people seem to, the memory of the Depression seems to be much more in the front of people's minds who lived through that era than does the memory of World War II. It lasted longer. It affected the terms of their lives more deeply. It was a historical experience, I think, that really shaped that whole generation's outlook.
When people talk these days of the greatest generation, that they often seems blend together both the Depression and World War II. Given the fact that the Depression started in 1929 and the war didn't end until 1945, is it right to blur the distinction between those two experiences, the generational experiences?
Well, as I understand it, the people who have been called the greatest generation and who take some pride in understanding themselves by that term is really the generation that fought World War II, and especially veterans of that war. And, of course, for them, this was a triumphal moment. I mean, the war was a good war, as wars go, if one could even speak that way. It was a war fought for a just cause and at a relatively small cost to this country. Our losses in terms of life were proportionally much, much less than virtually every other combatant. And in 1945, as Winston Churchill once said, when the war was fully finished and after both Germany and Japan had surrendered, Churchill said, "The United States stands at this moment at the summit of the world." It was a fully and unqualifiedly triumphal moment for the United States. So why wouldn't the people who participated in that great upheaval feel proud of themselves and be perfectly happy to be known as the greatest generation? My own view is that generations don't really have different endowments of courage and moral quality and moxie and so on, but that generation had an opportunity to demonstrate some of those qualities, and that's how they got the nickname.
Did World War I, about which you've also written, have the same formative influence on Americans as the Depression in World War II?
No, I would say absolutely not. In the history of this society, this country, the United States, World War I was really quite a brief and unremarkable moment in many ways. The United States was only a formal belligerent for 19 months, from April of 1917 until November of 1918. We never fielded a sizable force in Europe until the very last weeks of the war, and the United States Army in World War I only fought two major battles, both of them in the last 45 or 55 days of the war in the fall of 1918. One of those battles, the Battle of San Miguel, was a four-day walkover. It didn't amount to anything. The longer one, the Battle of Mazar Gun, but that lasted over a month. But the United States' contribution to the victory in World War I was kind of marginal. The engagement of this society was fairly marginal. It in no way resembled the full and deep and protracted mobilization of World War II. We put about 4 million men under arms in World War I, about 2 million of whom actually got overseas. World War II, we put 16 million men under arms, and about 12 million of them got overseas. So the scales are just completely different.
Mm-hmm. People often identify themselves as belonging to a particular generation, and yet, with very few exceptions, historians haven't focused as much on generations as they have on other categories, race, class, gender, ethnicity, for example. And I wonder about that difference between how the public pursues an understanding of the past and how professional historians often have done it. Should historians focus more on generations than they do? Or, to put it a slightly different way, is a generation a useful historical category?
Well, I think it is a useful category with a... Of course, one immediately adds caveats that it's a pretty fuzzy concept. But, for example, I've just finished reading Joseph Ellis's book, Founding Brothers, which is really premised on the notion that the what we usually call the Founding Fathers were all people of roughly comparable age who lived through a very definitive and shaping moment in history, and it was their shared experience, their shared encounter with those events that shaped their identity and that in turn shaped the event itself through which they were living. And I think Ellis makes very skillful use of the notion of a generational bond in the Revolutionary era. And I think there are other moments like that, too. The Civil War generation, certainly through the late 19th century, had a sense of themselves as having lived through and played a major role in one of the great historical events of the modern era. The Depression and World War II, I think, had a similar effect on people. So it's a loose and fuzzy concept, but I do think if you put it in slightly different terms, that is, the effects of shared experience, it looks a little more analytically respectable.
I wonder, maybe to follow up on that question, why, given what you said, historians haven't done somewhat more with it than they have?
Well, probably because it's such a loose and elusive and fuzzy concept, and it seems to really come into prominence for us only when we're looking at a generation that encountered a major historical development like the Revolution, the Civil War, the Great Depression, World War II, and so on. So I don't think it's a universally useful concept, but I do think when we confront these great historical moments that people share deeply, it shapes their outlook going forward and probably has echoes and resonances in future history. For example, it was often said in the 1960s that one of the distinctive features of the Kennedy administration, at least, was that the junior officers of World War II had now ascended to full command, people like John F. Kennedy, who was a lieutenant in the war. And the generation of the generals and the colonels who had fought the war was passing from the scene. Dwight Eisenhower, of course, just immediately preceding. So I think there is some flavor to the 1960s of a generation that had fought World War II. I believe they, with concerted effort and the application of skill and intelligence and discipline, could conquer any problem they faced. And that was the legacy to them of having participated in that prior event, World War II. So Kennedy thought he could win the Cold War. Lyndon Johnson thought he could defeat poverty. Vietnam was just another challenge to be faced and overcome. The idea that there were limits to human striving, that there were problems that were insoluble, was not a lesson that World War II taught particularly well to that generation. And we saw the price that was paid for that experience in the 1960s.
Kennedy begins the decade at his inauguration by stating that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. We associate the 60s with a younger generation often, particularly when we look at later events, but it's actually the World War II generation that Kennedy is talking about.
That's right.
I'm curious, thanks to Tom Brokaw and others, this notion of the greatest generation, this World War II generation, has really taken hold. And I wonder, as someone who has written about that period, but also as a commentator on current events, how do you explain that, and is it justified?
Well, to be honest, I think part of the mystique of this concept of the greatest generation as it's applied to the World War II era people is a kind of Valentine to these to our senior citizens who are passing from the scene. I mean, one hears it said that 1,000 World War II veterans per day are dying because they've reached that point in the life cycle. So I think it's partly a Valentine to a departing generation. But I think it's mixed up with a lot of nostalgia for a moment in which this country faced issues that had a certain kind of clarity. Where we knew who our adversaries were, we knew the job that needed doing, that we got it done, we fought in a good cause, there were no ambiguities, morally or otherwise, about what we were doing. That's not a circumstance in which we found ourselves in recent years. So I think part of the fascination with that prior era is a longing for the moral clarity and the certainties that it embodied.
You've mentioned that you give talks to members of that generation. I wonder if this subject ever comes up. What's their reaction to being so identified?
Well, basically, I think they love it. Who wouldn't? I mean, it's quite flattering to be described that way. Although, to be honest, some of the more thoughtful members of that generation that I encounter will say, you know, I don't know why we should be called the greatest generation, particularly because of our participation in World War II, since most of us, right until the 11th hour, until virtually December 7th, 1941, were dead set determined not to get into World War II. We were isolationist and parochial and provincial in our outlook about the world. So what was so great about that? We didn't have any foresight, and all we were concerned about was getting a good job and staying out of the fracas that was convulsing the rest of the world. So in a fuller historical view, I mean, their measure of courage and wisdom and commitment and foresight and so on doesn't look quite as dramatic as it does if you just focus on the war itself.
Near the end of your book, Freedom from Fear, you write of the mysterious zone where history mixes with memory to breed national myths. You've touched on this a little bit already, but I wonder if you could expand a little bit on how America's memory of World War II differs from the war's actual history.
Well, I'll tell you a little story. Some years ago when I was doing research for the book, actually, I traveled to Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands with a group of World War II veterans and let them take me around and show me where they'd fought, and they told me their stories and so on. And then I gave some lectures on the overall strategy of the war, one thing or another. And at the end of this, one of the people, he'd been a Marine Corps flyer, came up to me and he said, kind of jokingly, he said, you know, until I heard you give those lectures, he said, I thought 42 other guys and I won the war single-handedly. Well, he was making a joke out of it, but I do think in some ways this has become our national mythology, that we won the war and that D-Day was the climactic battle that finally vanquished the Nazis and so on. Well, there's something to that, of course, but in relative terms, our contribution to the victory is another matter. If you ask the question, what nation, what people paid the highest price in terms of blood and treasure to defeat the Nazis? It's not the United States. It's the Soviet Union. We lost a little over 400,000 people in World War II. Not a small number. I don't mean to make little of it at all. But the Soviets lost 24 million people, 16 million of whom were civilians. I mean, those numbers can't be put in the same scale. But our national mythology is that we took them on virtually single-handedly and we whipped them. And it's not that simple, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. What should we make of the difference between how, is this distinction valid, a professional historian looks at things and the public at large looks at things? If there's a gap there, should it be bridged? And if so, how?
Well, professional historians are committed by training and temperament, you might say, to telling the truth as clearly and objectively as possible. The father of us all, Henry Adams, often thought to be the first scientific historian of the American past, once said something to the effect that even the extinction of the human race should simply be just another fact that the historian puts in his ledger book. Well, what he was saying, that's clearly a crazy kind of hyperbole, but what he was really getting at was that the historian has to try to be as dispassionate and as objective as possible. As citizens and inhabitants of this culture that goes on through history, we have a different attitude. We want to think well of ourselves. We want to acknowledge the problems in our past, to be sure, but we want, on balance, to think that we're living in a society that's had a history it can be proud of. And occasionally, these quite understandable impulses of us all to think well of our historical project get crosswise with the insistence of professional historians that there are things in our past that really are quite troubling and that we need to confront directly. But sometimes people are reluctant to do that.
Well, Professor Kennedy, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
I've been visiting with David Kennedy, the author of Freedom from Fear, The American People in Depression and War.
Historians have long debated whether President Franklin Roosevelt had advanced knowledge of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, and whether Admiral Husband Kimball and Lieutenant General Walter Short were guilty of failing to anticipate the Japanese attack. Our guest this week, Robert Stinnett, gives us his take on all of this. Stinnett is the author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor.
Pearl Harbor is a story that won't go away. The Japanese carrier and submarine attack on Hawaii took place 60 years ago on December 7, 1941. President Franklin D. Roosevelt described the event as a sneak attack by Japan and told America and the world that it was a day of infamy. Shortly after the attack, a special presidential commission found the Hawaiian military commanders were derelict in not discovering and fighting off the Japanese military force that caused the death of nearly 3,000 Americans and set off World War II. Despite 10 American military and congressional investigations, over 300 books, countless media stories, motion pictures, and television documentaries, the truth of Pearl Harbor has remained elusive. A recent Pearl Harbor movie, highly touted, sank at the box office when audiences discovered a hokey love story on the screen and not the 1941 truth. The Pearl Harbor truth has been hidden in secret U.S. Navy, Army, and FBI files. These documents, which are unassailable, show that President Roosevelt adopted a U.S. Navy plan to provoke Japan into attacking the Pacific Fleet in Hawaii. The plan was a backdoor approach to war, design of using the Japanese overt act of war to inflame the American people and end the isolation movement in this country that wanted nothing to do with Europe's war. The backdoor was aimed at Adolf Hitler's Germany, Japan's partner in 1941. A treaty between the Axis nations of Germany, Italy, and Japan called for military assistance if any member of the Axis became involved in a state of war with another nation. To trigger the state of war, FDR adopted the secret U.S. Navy plan and authorized 8 provocations directed at Japan. Throughout 1940 and 41, United States naval cruisers violated international law and sailed into Japanese territorial waters. The Pacific Fleet was ordered to remain in Hawaiian waters as a Japanese lure. In conjunction with the British and Dutch governments, embargoes were leveled at Japan that cut off her access to natural resources such as oil. To gauge Japanese reaction to the provocations, the Roosevelt administration intercepted and decoded the most secret Japanese military and diplomatic codes. By November 25, 1941, the codebreakers provided FDR with information that Japan's military might be headed for Hawaii. Japan was given clear sailing to Pearl Harbor. The U.S. declared the North Pacific a vacant sea and ordered all U.S. shipping and air reconnaissance from the ocean's waters. The Hawaiian military commanders, Admiral Husband E. Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short, were ordered to stand aside and permit a Japanese overt act of war. The rest is history. Japan attacked Hawaii on December 7th. Kimmel and Short stood aside. The next day, FDR asked Congress to declare a state of war with Japan. On December 11th, Adolf Hitler asked his parliament to declare a state of war with the United States. World War II had begun.
You've been listening to Robert Sinnott, the author of Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. This is Talking History. To conclude our show for this week, we welcome back Dr. America. Thanksgiving, the subject of his commentary last month, has come and gone, and now it's time for Americans to be getting the stuff we're giving for Christmas. This week, under the tree of the magnificent but wholly imaginary American Studies Museum, Dr. America unwraps a few of the cultural roles of American gift-giving.
The National Retail Federation estimates that Americans will spend $185 billion on gifts this holiday season. Along with his fellow Americans, Dr. America generally likes to think that he is following his own personal preferences in selecting gifts. But in his brilliant article, The American Way of Celebrating Christmas, sociologist Theodore Kaplow suggests that we tend to follow social rules in Christmas gift giving, rules with lots of complicated corollaries. For example, the law of relativity, gift giving relativity that is, says that gifts are not given randomly, but to express and reinforce social relationships. We give gifts to people we relate to. Sometimes these people are relatives. Sometimes they're people we work with. Occasionally, families or offices draw names to channel gift giving, but such a lottery is itself an expression of the social bond. What Kaplow calls scaling rules demand that gifts be scaled to the emotional significance of the relationship. During this holy season, we routinely convert feelings and sentiments into commodities. The gift is both a way of pleasing the recipient and a way of reinforcing social status hierarchies. The size of your gift has less to do, in fact, with your actual affection for people than it does with social expectations of affection in these relationships. Spouses come first, and then children. Dr. America's parents are less important than his own immediate family, but more important than his siblings. You can't give a bigger gift to your secretary than to your husband. You can't favor one child over the others. You can't give to one set of in-laws but not the other. The crack research team of the American Studies Museum has discovered that most disputes over what gift to bestow can be traced to differing estimations of the value of relationships. Suitability rules determine who may give what to whom. You can't give underwear to business associates. You can't give alcohol to minors or to alcoholics. You can't give pink to men. Adults may give money to children, but not vice versa. Men can't give diamonds or intimate apparel to every woman they know. Women can't give flowers to men. You shouldn't give clothing that doesn't fit, and you especially shouldn't give women clothing that's too large. You can't give things that are too practical or utilitarian. Dr. America once gave Mrs. America 5 cubic yards of black dirt. That did not exactly pass the suitability rules. The reciprocity rule says basically that unless you are a child, if someone gives you a gift, you have to return the favor. Conversely, if you give a gift, you can expect to get one, thus providing a potential ulterior motive for generosity. This may be, in fact, why Americans wish each other many happy returns. There is one complicated clause in the reciprocity rule, and that's the Santa Clause. Adults are permitted to spoil their children with too many gifts, especially if the gifts come from Santa, the season's symbol of generosity and indulgence. Santa Claus decontaminates the commercialism of the season and lets us feel good about wrapping a spiritual holiday in materialism. When all goes well, the exchange of Christmas gifts both symbolizes and strengthens our social relationships. But sometimes we break these arbitrary rules, and sometimes even the best of intentions lead to disaster. When gifts don't match the recipient's status or size or taste, or when the gift violates their perception of a relationship, there can be acute social embarrassment. Fortunately, in America, people feel free to return inappropriate gifts in the time allotted for this ritual of return, starting the day after Christmas. From the American Studies Museum, this is Dr. America, looking the gift horse right in the mouth.
And you've been listening to Dr. America, James Farrell in real life, professor of history and principal gift officer at St. Olaf College. Dr. America's commentaries come to us courtesy of public radio station WCAL-FM in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. Until next time, from the studios of KIUS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.